All right, so first thing, can you tell us your name and your positions at the ECCC and a summary of what you were doing there?
My name is Susan Lamb. I am an international criminal lawyer of 22 years experience. I served with the ECCC between January 2009 and approximately the end of 2013. On appointment, I was the senior judicial coordinator of all chambers of the ECCC. At a midpoint in my period of service, and once the trial in case two, the ECCC's core case, gained momentum, my functions were recalibrated and I became the senior legal officer to the trial chamber specifically. That configuration of post continued until the end of the trial chamber's mandate, including after my departure.
Awesome. And tell us a little bit about some of the challenges that you faced at the ECCC, and I'm particularly thinking about the trial chamber here. So these could be challenges pertaining to international law and the way that that was being formed in the trial chamber, but also for the court's policies and procedures and just sort of the way that things worked.
Well, the ECCC contained a handful of challenges that are not particularly specific to any international justice initiative. It's probably useful to start with the more mundane challenges because in my experience, these were often overlooked in Cambodia and the specificities of the ECCC tended to be exaggerated. My background, I had come immediately to the ECCC from the ICTR in Arusha, where I was the chef de cabinet and the senior legal officer of Trial Chamber 1 there. And so I had been there for about 4 years. This was a tribunal that had been in existence for some 18 years, actually probably slightly less at that point, but the ICTR at its height was overseeing about 18 single or multi-accused trials during my tenure. And so that trial management experience was brought with me to the ECCC. And on arrival, I saw a court that was fledgling and that wanted to start running within a couple of months of me arriving. And it had all of the usual challenges of getting a trial of this size and magnitude up and running. And but in a sort of context where there was very little experience in actually doing so and a lot of public and civil society nervousness about the capacity of the court to do so. So let me start with some of the challenges that are endemic to international criminal trials of this magnitude at the ECCC. Well, the first is just ensuring that the courtroom infrastructure and all personnel are in place. That process kind of was nearing a conclusion at the time I was appointed in January 2009. I was recruited along with a handful of other senior-ish staff, drawn largely from other tribunals, knowing that we had operational experience in getting the trials up and running. The physical infrastructure was in place by that point. The judicial investigation, certainly in case one, had concluded and was ongoing in case two, but no trial had actually taken place there. We had early challenges in terms of setting up appropriate security protocols, confidentiality protocols, ensuring that the courtrooms were functional in terms of witness protection and all of that. They were relatively minor challenges. More major challenges concerned identifying who the parties to the ECCC first trial would be. You're doubtless aware that the ECCC has a fairly distinct system of civil party or victim participation. That had a number of elements that are frequently overlooked in terms of trial management challenges in cases of this magnitude. The most pressing of which in January 2009 were that we were under a lot of pressure, both simultaneously to commence the trial as soon as humanly possible, while at the same time allowing a broad right of participation to as many survivors as possible. And those two goals pulled in opposite directions, basically. So that I think kind of, that is a generic trial management challenge. There are many things you can start a trial with, without knowing and without having everything done and dusted. About one thing that you absolutely can't do without is knowing who your parties are. And so that I think was one thing. So managing that had a very specific impact on the trial chamber's operational abilities, but it was overcome. The trial commenced in March 2009, within 6 weeks of my arrival. We squared that circle basically by making provisional decisions on civil party admissibility, otherwise reviewing dozens of applications and making conclusive determinations of admissibility would have deferred the opening of the trial to a far later date. That was a process that we actually revised in case two, because it had certain undesirable consequences as well for the civil parties, some of whom had the unfortunate experience of having achieved provisional admission in January or February 2009, only to be ultimately declared inadmissible in the verdict. But the challenge there was we were between a rock and a hard place. It was either make those admissibility decisions in a conclusive manner but delay the opening of the trial, or tolerate the system that we adopted. There was a reason why we had little choice but to open the trial in March 2009. I can no longer remember the specifics, but it concerned donor optics. As you know, the ECCC is a court of voluntary contributions, and we were under significant indirect pressure to ensure that we had a verdict no later than mid-2010. And so then that actually kind of segues quite naturally into some other trial management challenges. One can only have a verdict in any international criminal tribunal if the verdict is firstly written, secondly, the trial is concluded, and thirdly, that the verdict's written, and finally, that it's rendered in all languages simultaneously. Most international criminal tribunals do require a verdict to be in more than one language. The ECCC is a little bit unique in the sense it requires three. Khmer it goes without saying, it's a court based in Cambodia. The verdicts must all, and decisions to have any impact at all must by definition be in Khmer. So Khmer English are immediately the operative languages of the court. The ECCC is saddled with a third language, namely the French language, which adds complexity, which adds time, which adds expense. The other thing that perhaps is buried within that language conundrum is the modalities of deliberation within the chambers. We have half the judges and the staff who are Khmer speaking, many of whom fortunately are bilingual. We have internationals who are largely English or French and or French speaking, with, if we're lucky, a modicum of Khmer. So one trial management tool that I in consultation with my judges and the ICTR had refined significantly as a trial management tool was to rely increasingly on oral decisions. They are a wonderful way of speeding up in-court processes. It enables a lot of mundane trial management decisions to be taken spontaneously without the need to remit a lot of issues for deliberation and judgment drafting. Our trial chamber president, who is an absolutely lovely man, Judge Neil Non, unfortunately did not speak fluent English. So oral decisions were really a challenge for us. And we did actually render them on a number of occasions, but to render them spontaneously because of the language barrier proved to be challenging. So that was, I think, one tangible way in which the language configuration worked in a manner that was slightly more cumbersome than in other international criminal tribunals. One innovation that is actually very common before the other international criminal tribunals, but took a little bit of introduction in Cambodia, was to empower me as the senior legal officer to meet informally with the parties and to render a lot of administrative to basically manage a lot of administrative issues on my own in consultation with the judges. So which usually cleared the way for the courtroom not to be cluttered with discussions about scheduling and ordinary ordinary day-to-day irritants that could dribble over into the courtroom, but could easily also be managed outside. So they were tactics and techniques that I was very familiar with from my previous work, and that actually was used far more than oral decision making in my practice, and it proved to be a good way of keeping things on track. The trials progressed pretty much at a speed and a rate that I would have expected, pretty much from my previous life. They did not progress noticeably slower than other trials of similar size and complexity before the other international criminal tribunals, which I think is an achievement on the part of the Cambodian courts.
Great. Well, let's maybe dive into maybe a few of the issues that you mentioned. So back in 2012, you gave an interview for an article on the ECCC where you mentioned that you wouldn't advocate the Cambodian model be used for future tribunals.
This was a discussion I gave to a legal researcher, We were discussing certain features of the ECCC that are inevitable and were unable to be changed by any functionary of the court. These included the fact that it was a hybrid tribunal located in Cambodia with two halves, with a Cambodian half and an international half. And I said that in any ideal circumstance, nobody would be negotiating to create a tribunal against such a backdrop. And in an ideal world, neither the UN nor the Cambodian government would be subject to such constraints. It would be possible to create a tribunal that was unified from the beginning, that could engage whatever staff from whatever background was most needed for operational reasons, and there would be no budgetary constraints whatsoever. This was not the environment anybody inherited in Cambodia. So I think to say that, well, no, I would never replicate this model anywhere else puts a pejorative spin on it. So for that reason, I very, very seldom gave interviews, because I knew that they would probably come out with a spin that I wouldn't quite intend. So my focus was very much on the operation of the court and making sure that the court operated as well as possible.
Gotcha. Well, thank you for giving us this one and for clarifying there. So maybe to rephrase then, what parts of the court did you think worked well and what didn't? What could have used improvement in the sense of we're hoping that people at future international tribunals will look to this for advice? So yeah. What advice do you have for them?
Okay. Well, I think the thing that worked, and let's not take anything away from this, is we actually achieved historic accountability for not only Khmer Rouge atrocities, but for the senior most survivors of the Khmer Rouge era. And that's no mean feat. And this was a trial of immense complexity. It would have challenged any legal system. As we know, the Cambodian legal system confronts a number of challenges of its own and comparatively few resources. So it is overwhelmingly an achievement that these trials took place at all. Furthermore, they took place and achieved a result that by and large has stood up to international scrutiny. The verdicts are well regarded. They're regarded as precedents. They're studied by scholars. They will be influential. They have been and will continue to be influential for international justice in years to come. And this is an achievement of the Cambodian people. These trials took place in Phnom Penh. They were rendered in the Khmer language. They were done with international assistance, but at the end of the day, they were Cambodian trials. So I think that's I think the first thing that I'd like to put on record, that they succeeded and that they happened. And I think knowing what I do about the amount of effort across so many different spheres of human activity and how many people are involved in making that happen and the effort required to kind of cohere that and bring it all together, I think that is an achievement. It's actually very hard to replicate. I think the fact that it was actually in country does actually add does add a dimension. I think there's a flip side to that as well, which I'll also mention, but I do think that wherever possible, trials should be held close to the site of the crimes in question and close to where the victims and perpetrators are based. There was an immediacy to the trials in Cambodia and a public resonance to the ECCC's activities that just was completely absent from the ICTY and the ICTR. So I think that that bears emphasizing. But I think with all of the strengths, I think you get the flip side as well. I think because of the location of the trials in Cambodia and the location of the court within the Cambodian justice system, some of those features of the Cambodian justice system are present from day one. One advantage that the ad hoc tribunals had by being remotely located is that they had a far greater capacity to shape the shape of the court and the nature of it in a manner that is, you know, the choosing of the architects of the court. We had to work within a structure that that was pre-existing and adapted. The other thing that I think probably is a little bit of a salutary lesson is to be a little bit modest in terms of what one's objectives are for a trial. The system of victim participation I've mentioned already, I think that was a triumph of massively overinflated expectations and perhaps a little bit of a dearth of sober planning and rational trial management in the beginning. That wasn't to say that the system wasn't ultimately repaired and put on a more sustainable track, but I think it's a textbook case of where possibly too many objectives are kind of overburdened on within a structure that is perhaps still fledgling. And I think some of the ambitions with which victim participation is burdened with perhaps need a little bit more sober reflection. For example, this idea that it's realistic for 4,000 victims to meaningfully take part on an individual basis in a complex criminal trial, I think that has to be completely critically reevaluated. The best that can happen is, I think, what you see before the ECCC in its current manifestation, is that there is some form of collectivized symbolic representation of victims and that they have a voice in a trial. I think nobody would argue that that isn't a good thing, but there are actually many ways of achieving that same result, many of which could have been far less burdensome than the system originally adopted. Yeah, I think also too, I think the broader lesson too is that the early challenges confronted by civil party participation were well-intentioned, but they involved a slightly too ready willingness to extrapolate a system that worked well in certain domestic contexts and grafted it onto an international criminal process without perhaps adequate contextualization or recognition that, you know, certain features that might inhere in a developed legal system like France may not be able to be directly replicated in trials of that sort of complexity. So yeah, I think there's a lesson in terms of be very, very careful just of cutting it. It's never a matter of cutting and pasting other models that might work somewhere else. There's always a specific context. There is always a need for careful adaptation and I think there was a bit of an assumption that Cambodia was somehow different, that there was a chance to do it better and do it more uniquely. And I think that I just, you know, in a way, this has been done before. You know, there's a lot of expertise already out there. In a way, we're trying to do what others have already done. There are really good lessons that can be learned, but these things are not laboratories. You know, I think there was a degree of willingness to experiment in the early days, which I think was both quite was actually quite a humbling thing to see. But I think sometimes that tendency got ahead of itself a bit.
Gotcha. All right, so let's turn to the trial chamber a bit. I'd like to talk a little bit about your interactions with the judges. Was there anyone that you particularly learned from or enjoyed working with, or if you have any anecdotes that you could share with us about the relationships between the judges or the staff and how they worked together, that would be great.
I enjoyed working with all of the trial chamber judges. There were none that I there were no exceptions to that. They were all very pleasant individuals to work with, and I enjoyed very cordial relationships with all of them. The two halves of the chamber got on very well as well. There was a good human environment in the trial chamber. There was inevitably a language barrier, but I think that was quite quickly overcome. The relationships were positive. They were very seldom, if ever, strained. One thing that I think this links to maybe the trial management discussion we had before. One thing that for me was quite critical in terms of ensuring that the trial chamber could operate with far greater flexibility and speed was measures that we took to empower President Nil Non in his responsibility to manage proceedings. There are sort of, as you'll know from your time in Cambodia, there are cultural differences between Cambodians and Europeans. The Khmer style is very consensus-based. It places a lot of a premium on making sure that everybody's okay with the decision. That in substance means deliberation with full participation. And when you're in the midst of a complex multi-accused trial and where the media is there every day expecting rapid decisions to be made, coupled with the language barrier and the fact that the two sides cannot spontaneously and instantaneously always communicate, we needed to develop new ways to ensure that the decision-making process could continue with the expeditiousness needed. One thing that we were able to achieve was to persuade President Nil Non to trust me as the senior legal officer to keep him apprised of pretty much every issue that was pending, and to trust that out of court those issues would be dealt with. This meant that the trial chamber could convene far less frequently than it had previously and discuss only those issues that did require closer examination and deliberation. We would usually deliberate on a Friday. From memory, trials generally sat Monday to Thursday, and Fridays were allocated to deliberations, finalizing decisions, reviewing translations, etc. That worked very well. We actually very quickly found our stride. I think it's full credit to Judge Nil Non for being flexible enough to kind of think outside the box and to kind of go with a more delegated model and to step away from a modality of operating that was perhaps not innately comfortable to the Cambodian judges, at least in the beginning. So that's, I think, one example. But I think otherwise the trial chamber worked as every other trial chamber I've ever worked with functioned. Namely, there would be decisions that had to be rendered, a trial that had to be managed. The trial would sit for as many days as it possibly could. There's an enormous sort of budgetary and public expectation that the court is in operation as much as possible. If there's no trial activity, there's usually a little bit of grumbling about, well, what's going on? Are you guys actually working? There's in fact a ton of work that goes on behind the scenes in terms of decision making and drafting, but to the extent possible, it's about keeping the trial on track and while ensuring that those decisions have a sort of flow to them as well. So that's the judges. That's kind of how we operated. The staff, I was very lucky. I was the only senior person in the court to not have a Cambodian counterpart. I've got the president to thank for that. He basically acknowledged that there was no senior Cambodian lawyer that had the relevant level of experience in trial management, and he very graciously allowed me to manage both sides of the chamber staffing-wise as well. Again, the Cambodian and international staff had a very good relationship. I was never aware of any tensions that was based on nationality or sort of international versus national. The Cambodian staff were generally bilingual, and some of them were trilingual. They had a lot of linguistic expertise. The main challenge as a manager that I confronted was that while everybody was very highly motivated, not everybody had the same level of technical expertise in international criminal law. It was a matter of, I think, managing international staff who were highly motivated, highly ambitious, wanted further opportunities to develop and to push themselves, and at the same time ensuring that the Cambodian staff could over time improve their ability to interact and function in that environment. If that relationship is poorly managed, the Cambodian staff could feel that they're nothing more than conduits between the international and national side of the court, and are used as glorified interpreters. And so we always tried to kind of avoid that impression. We overcame that by actually having a specifically designated international legal officer attached to the national side of the court, whose primary function was basically to work closely with the Cambodian staff and ensure that their contribution to the work of the chambers over time could become more substantial. And I believe you've interviewed one of these people already. So that's where he fitted into the organogram, and that was the rationale for recruiting somebody in that function. It was practically impossible for me to steer the trial and keep everything on track and steer the verdict while at the same time building capacity to the extent that we would have liked. So hence we employed somebody with a specific function to do just that.
Great. And yes, we did speak with Russell Hopkins, who I think is who you're referring to there. So thinking a bit about the trials themselves, and keeping within what has been released to the public, of course, were there any particular accused or survivor stories that really stood out and resonated with you?
I think almost all of them did. I think it's really impossible to spend even 5 minutes listening to a survivor or a witness to what happened in Cambodia without being profoundly moved. I think the one that it's really almost impossible to select one. I think there's two that kind of stuck out. I think from case one, the one that really affected me was the testimony of one of the two child survivors of S21. I remember it stood out because he was born the same year I was. And it caused me to reflect on my own childhood. And you know, at the time I was 7 years old, this small boy who was born within months of my own birth date, you know, was witnessed everything that he had, and yet 45 years later, here we are.
Yeah. I can imagine how having those kinds of connections would be really challenging or I could see how that one would resonate with you.
Yeah, so I think that was the one that really stayed with me from case one. From case two, the lady I think I'll never forget was one of the civil parties, of course, had a completely impossible task where they had to aggregate there are approximately 4,000 civil parties into a very, very tiny number of civil parties that could speak to victim impact generally. And I think from memory, there was approximately half a dozen individuals that could be selected from 4,000 to speak generally to the impact of the crimes. There was a lady by the name of Sofani Bey, who was one of the civil parties from California. Her testimony was just absolutely heart-wrenching. I think whoever made the decision to select That story in particular was really spot on. But I think that process of trying to reduce that level of suffering in case two to six individuals or 12 or however many it was virtually impossible. But I think just, yeah, I think she had a quiet eloquence that the story that she had to tell was just absolutely, absolutely mind-boggling and just heartbreaking. But I think that there was also the manner in which she did it and so I think it really did have a fabulous impact.
Great. Well, thank you so much for sharing those with us. Thinking forward a little, what do you think the impact of the ECCC will be for Cambodia, both today and maybe 20 years from now?
I think it'll be immense, but I think it's really hard to measure. And I think it's the same with Rwanda in the sense I find it impossible to believe that having gone through this process and having produced this jurisprudence, this historical record, that it won't have a fairly profound and catalyzing effect on the country. But I think the exact format that will take is hard to predict. And I think it's really down to our Cambodian colleagues to pick this up and run with it and really use it to achieve real world improvements to the judicial system of Cambodia and to accountability. But I think there's a lot I could observe. I was in Cambodia for just short of 5 years. And even in that time, I mean, when I compare the discourse in Cambodia from January 2009, which I think it was one of almost total skepticism about the court, about the capacity for justice, about the ability of this tribunal to deliver anything whatsoever. Even in my own thought processes, I thought, look, I'm really glad to be here and this is a fantastic and interesting experience, but is it just too little too late? And I don't think that anymore. I think that one thing that completely I was not prepared for when landing in Cambodia was how little information ordinary people have about the Khmer Rouge era. And I realized that, well, it's no great surprise. I think that it's not taught. It's not until the work of DC CAM and other organizations started to get some momentum, it wasn't part of the school curriculum. There were not widely available Khmer language histories of the period. And even if there were, you know, literacy rates and internet accessibility, et cetera, perhaps wouldn't allow for its dissemination. So I think, and then of course the survivor population largely suffers from PTSD. And so perhaps even the ability for intergenerational communication of what happened in Cambodia was very, very limited. And I was very surprised in the context of the first trial to be made aware of a lot of national myths about what the Khmer Rouge era was about. And people openly saying, my goodness, actually these were Khmer people killing other Khmer people. I always thought it was the Vietnamese that participated in these atrocities. So I think kind of, then I saw the flourishing of a lot of other initiatives outside. Trials can only do so much, of course. I think at the end of the day, they're about determining the responsibility of a handful of senior perpetrators, but they don't innately do much to reconcile communities. But one thing that I did see is that the trials had a catalyzing effect on a lot of other initiatives. I attended a number of DC CAM events, for example, that were interactive fora within villages. If an individual testified in case one, I remember sort of being taken to his village where the villagers would watch that testimony and they would reflect on their own experience and what it meant to them 40 years after the fact to see these events come to light, what they thought about Doik and what justice would actually mean in this context. And in many respects, they were interesting discussions in the sense that after 40 years, they weren't exactly secrets, but I think there were a lot of half-buried assumptions that people had about each other. And clearly these people had lived together over decades and had found some way of living together. But I nonetheless found it very meaningful to see these sorts of discussions happen. Now, you don't need a trial to do that. This could have happened at any point, but pretty much every other many other transitional justice initiatives had in fact founded before the trials got underway. The Renaxe petitions of the 1980s hadn't really gone anywhere. Somehow it took the energizing effect of the trials to kind of make it somehow appropriate for these things to be to be given a public airing. And I saw that very dramatically in the first 2 to 3 years I was there. And it was a source of quite a lot of satisfaction. By the time I left, the trial in case 2/1 had finished. We had a draft verdict. It was really business as usual at the ECCC from that point. And it was sort of really part of the discourse of the country, and sort of it had normalized far more. And so I hope those, I hope in the 9 or so years since I've left, you know, those discussions have continued and they've matured and they've led in other directions.
Great.
Yeah. I mean, it had an impact on my own household, actually, in the sense that I had a housekeeper for the whole 5 years I was here. And I remember on the day that the case one verdict came out, she came to work in floods of tears. And she said that her father, for the first time in her life, had admitted that he had lost a relative in S21, and that he had, over the decades that had followed, made a number of trips to Phnom Penh from the provinces trying to find him among the records. And for some reason, which she didn't understand, he felt unable to tell his own family that he was doing this. Somehow with the verdict being released, it became possible to talk about it.
Oh, well, thank you for sharing that. That's really, it's nice to hear those kind of personal stories along with the rest of the court.
Yeah.
That's all of the questions we have. So thank you so much for speaking with us. We really appreciate it.
Oh, that's absolutely my pleasure. And all the very best for the project. If there's anything else I can assist you with, please let me know.
Thank you.